Mrs. Baker was a favorite teacher down the street at the Interlochen Elementary School. It was under her wing that I shook off the bad taste of an abusive second grade teacher and learned to take charge of my own education, filling in the mandatory with that which really interested me. It was in her class that I ate my way through the math curriculum in 4 months, often waking up in the middle of the night and working ahead in my book just for the sheer joy of manipulating numbers and learning new mathematical concepts. Her husband was a venerable professor at the Interlochen Arts Academy, where he taught composition and music theory. By the time I got to know him, when I was in junior high, he was on his last legs and was famous for falling asleep during his own lectures. But there was a modular synthesizer in his studio, so I happily sat through his narcoleptic lectures with sneering students several years my senior in order to get put on the key list so I could wander down to the basement of the cafeteria after dinner and poke around the fascinating world of electronic sound creation and manipulation. In the mid-1960s, the synthesizer played two rather restrictive roles in music making. In popular music, its bleeps and bloops were used almost exclusively as a novelty, goosing up a track that featured more conventional instrumentation and arrangements. It was also somewhat popular in an academic environment, where its ability to create and modify pure tones offered a fascinating petri dish in which to try out different kinds of sonic experimentation. Much of the early electronic music created on synthesizers had a lot in common with its acoustic cousins in serious composition. In other words, academically interesting and nearly impossible to listen to. Then, in 1968, Walter Carlos released Switched on Bach and almost single-handedly bridged the gap between the popular and the academic and brought the synthesizer out from the shadows. The synthesizer that switched on Old Man Bach was one of Robert Moog's famous early modular synthesizers, in which a whole array of sound-generating oscillators and signal processors was patched together and tweaked to create new timbres of sound. enormously expensive and monstrously complicated. You could easily spend all day patching and tweaking to get just the sound you wanted, or, far more frequently, some sound you didn't want that was interesting nevertheless, and then have to tear it all down and start all over again to get a different sound. Recreating a sound meant keeping pages of complicated notes detailing which module was plugged into what, in which order, and at what setting. Forgetting even one parameter could mean the sound you got yesterday was lost forever. Plus, these gigantic beasts, often taking up an entire studio wall, were monophonic, meaning they only produced one note at a time. One can start to imagine the difficulty of recording such an instrument, and it is a tribute to Carlos's skill as a programmer and player that he was able to get such polished performances of Baroque classics out of such an unwieldy beast. He may have been crazy, but he was no fool. The intricate interwoven lines of Bach's celebrated fugues were particularly well suited for electronic realization. Because much of Bach's work relies on the complex interplay of several lines of related melodies, the monophonic restriction of early synthesizers was less a liability than it would have been in trying to recreate the lush chords and sonorities of later romantic composers, such as Beethoven. Also, the pure tonalities that the synthesizer created worked quite well in a Baroque music, in which precision is often more important than expression. Still, the tedious complexity of building up these layered fugues using the unwieldy and unforgiving modular Moog boggles the mind. In one of Dr. Baker's workshops, a student asked why he hadn't purchased a polyphonic synthesizer for the studio. This was in the mid-1970s, when such things existed, although barely. Dr. Baker scoffed and pointed out how all the knobs and buttons and patch bays on his synthesizer were devoted to the processing of a single signal. In order to play and control two notes, you'd get half the processing power, with each increment in polyphony resulting in a corresponding decrease in processing ability. Besides, he pointed out, you could make the synthesizer polyphonic if you really wanted to, and he proceeded to show us how. He dialed up a sine wave, the simplest of the basic sound waves. That particular machine also had square waves, triangle waves, and white noise as sound-generating sources. Then, patching it through a couple of filters and carefully tweaking those filters' parameters, he was able to isolate and amplify one of the tone's harmonics, and, with more patching and tweaking, he eventually ended up with a major chord. He recorded a few seconds of this to tape, tore the patch chords out, and slowly, painstakingly did it again, emphasizing different harmonics and creating a different chord. That went down on tape as well. He repeated this process three more times over the next couple of hours until he had several seconds of five different chords laid to tape. Then, getting out his razor blade and calculator, he figured out how long he wanted each chord to play and at what tempo, then measured out an appropriately long piece of tape of the corresponding chord. He then carefully taped those cut pieces together, and, a mere 4 hours later, he had the backing chords for the first measure of Auld Lang Syne. He proudly played the resulting 3 seconds of cut tape, and convinced all of us that, while you could make the synthesizer polyphonic, it might not be too late to switch majors and become an actor. Switched on Bach was a giant hit, one of the only classical albums in history to go platinum, and it spawned a brief and often humorous raft of imitators, who eagerly fired up the synthesizer and switched on, plugged in, turned on, or otherwise electrified some vein of music with varying degrees of success. I even have a dusty old album of transmogrified Scott Joplin rags, which doesn't really work at all. Carlos himself mined the territory for a few more albums of transcribed classical pieces, culminating in his 1975 By Request album, which is a combination of some of his early experimental electronic pieces created while studying under Vladimir Yusachevsky at the famed Princeton Electronic Music Center, first of its kind in the U.S., and odd realizations of a bewildering variety of source material, from Bach to Bacharach. It's a schizophrenic album, bouncing around madly from high culture to low and back again, and ends with the startling Pompous Circumstances, an extended electronic meditation on Edward Elgar's Graduation War Horse as refracted through the prism of many different styles and composers. The fact that By Request is such a schizophrenic album may be related to the personal life of its creator. Walter Carlos was in the unenviable and unimaginably difficult position of being trapped in the body of the wrong gender. Although a man on the outside, he was convinced that he was really a woman. The schism this created was so difficult and painful that it nearly killed him, and he resorted to that most drastic of corrective surgeries, the sex change operation. Walter disappeared from the limelight, stopped recording, and was reborn as Wendy Carlos, the person she always felt she was meant to be. 4 years later, she released her first album under her new name, a 2-disc set of electronic interpretations of what many consider to be Bach's greatest work, the Brandenburg Concertos. After the warm critical reaction, she returned to recording again full-time, scoring a couple of Stanley Kubrick films, Clockwork Orange and The Shining. and working on painstakingly and, if you ask me, pointlessly recreating the subtle and complex timbres of an orchestra in a purely digital medium. Her grand thesis of synthetic orchestration, digital moonscapes, is virtually indistinguishable from an actual orchestra. I played it once for my stepfather, Frank, a doctor of music and clarinet virtuoso, and he agreed it did sound just like a real orchestra, playing bad music. Carlos's sex change is a mysterious subject. A giant pink elephant in the living room. Everybody knows about it, but nobody says anything. Look up reviews or go shopping for music, and there's no mention of Walter whatsoever. Perhaps that's as it should be, the personal details of a composer's life remaining personal and entirely irrelevant to the music he or she creates. Perhaps since Carlos always felt herself to be a woman, it's perfectly appropriate to refer to her as her in all phases of her life. Biographical sketches mention that she studied at Brown and Columbia before her success with Switched On Bach, but not that she was a he at that point. But if you look up old lists, Walter is the one who hit the charts in 1968, not Wendy. I recently went to her website to try to find out some more information about this personal crisis and when and how she dealt with it. I wasn't there to gawk or ridicule, I just wanted some more information. After poking around a bit, I found a section called On Prurient Matters that looked promising. In it, Carlos rants for 8 pages about how cruel and stupid and bigoted and hateful people can be, which I certainly don't doubt, without ever once mentioning why people were being so cruel and stupid and bigoted and hateful. I can understand her frustration at some people's fixation on her admittedly unusual biological and psychological situation, and her fear that her life's work will be overshadowed by narrow-minded, knee-jerk prejudices, but you have to already know what she's talking about to know what she's talking about. It's all quite mysterious. When the first Switched On Bach albums hit the market, Carlos and longtime co-producer Rachel Elkind included survey postcards asking buyers what they thought of the music and what they'd like to hear synthesized in the future. Because the painstaking process needed to bring these pieces to fruition precluded any possibility of live performance, the postcards were a way to try to get some audience feedback. By Request was, as the title suggests, an attempt to satisfy some of those requests. So there are a couple of character dances from The Nutcracker and versions of Eleanor Rigby and What's New Pussycat nestled up next to respectful interpretations of Bach and a not-so-respectful reinterpretation of Wagner's Wedding March from Lohengrin. But the cornerstone of the album is the remarkable pompous circumstances. Carlos uses Elgar's theme as the basis for a remarkably inventive series of variations. And not just variations, but variations designed to sound like another composer's work, or in some cases, such as the William Tell variation, like a specific piece. It is a wondrously strange piece, complex and humorous, and shows off Carlos's training in music theory and composition, as well as her virtuosic synthesizer technique. It is a style of writing variations on a theme that isn't done very often because it is murderously difficult. In fact, the only comparable piece that really comes to mind is mad musical genius Tom Lehrer's Fantasia on Clementine, in which he dresses the minor 49er up in the clothes of Cole Porter, Mozart, and Gilbert and Sullivan, among others.
Era leggera e come un ferry, e sue shoes numero 9, herring boxes senza tops, sandale per Clementina, sì, per Clementina, sì, per Clementina, sandale per Clementina, sandale per Clementina, 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 Clementina. Herring boxes senza tops, sandale per Clementina. Herring boxes senza tops, sandale per Clementina. Che sciagura Clementina, che sciagura Clementina. Cara Clementina, cara Clementina. Na 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 na. Well.
Supposing at this rather dramatic juncture in the narrative, one of our modern cool school of composers had tried writing a verse, the next one might have come out like this.
Drove those ducklings to the water, yep, rock. Every morning like 9 a.m., whoop-bop. Got hung up on a splinter, got hung up on a splinter. Klugemop. Fell into the foamy brine. Dig that crazy Clementine.
There's also, come to think of it, a wonderful outtake from XTC's studio sessions for Nonsuch that includes Andy Partridge riffing on his song That Wave in the style of The Smiths, The Cure, and Bob Dylan, which is included in his mail-order-only Fuzzy Warbles set of effluvia.
I think I'm going to kill myself. Oh, oh God. Oh, Christ, I'm so unhappy.
Smith's version. That wave, that wave, that wave pulled me into your head.
that way. Throw me out of your head. We are within the promises, dizzy with planets cascading. Well, I flew down to the bottom of the sea, where I questioned the fishes of the body. Well, I was in heaven, but just cloud 11. Hey, dance and
Carlos sends the venerable Elgar theme through a musical funhouse of styles, bouncing madly between Bach and Scott Joplin and Sousa and Stephen Foster and Scottish bagpipes. It is an exhilarating exercise and a truly remarkable piece of music. I found By Request used in Spokane one summer while visiting my father. I had fairly recently waded into the murky waters of musical appreciation and was slowly and unsurely building up my meager collection. To give you a sense of how unfocused my tastes were at that time, I also picked up a used copy of AC/DC's If You Want Blood live album on that same shopping trip. I was 13 and teetering precariously on the knife edge of adolescence. My dad had lived in Spokane for a couple of years and was doing what he always did, blowing into a new town, making a lot of noise and friends before sabotaging those relationships and disappearing into the night and starting it up all over again someplace else. Growing up, my absent father was my hero, largely because he wasn't there. A strong, charming, demonstrative man, my father was a professional ballet dancer for years, including a stint in the prestigious New York City Ballet under legend George Balanchine. In later years, his blonde hair thinned and his chiseled physique softened and then blew up like a balloon under cancer therapy, but he was always a powerful presence, commanding attention and respect wherever he went. What he did with that attention and respect was another story, but he was a very charismatic man, quick to make connections. He made everybody feel special, from his boss to the waitress down at the corner diner. He had a dark side, but kept it fairly well hidden most of the time. Relentlessly curious, he was an avid reader and writer, and many of our times together included visiting bookstores and writing round-robin poems. I'd see him once or maybe twice a year, and those were always special, cherished times when he'd lavish attention on me. I yearned for those times when I was a kid, and he could seemingly do no wrong. But that was all starting to change as I got older. I was starting to see cracks in his facade, and started noticing the destructive patterns he repeated, and the way he kept everybody, even ultimately me, at arm's length. My own loss of innocence, psychologically, if not physically, in matters sexual, was giving me a new context in which to see the world, and I was beginning to see evidence of his confused and desperately hidden sexuality. On this trip, he decided that we weren't father and son, but brothers, which I initially took as a compliment, but later came to see as a cop-out. He didn't want to be my father, didn't want the responsibility, and his attraction to strong and supple young men was clouding our relationship. The physicality, which had always been part of our relationship, started to get strained, and his wrestling got a little too intense and violent for me, culminating in the night he playfully threw a couch on me and nearly broke my arm. For the first time, I could see the fear behind his blustery bravura and charm. It is always a difficult moment when a young man realizes his father is all too human, no better than any other random man, and that summer knocked him cleanly off the pedestal I had put him on with his blessing. For the first time, I could see the shadow of mortality in his eyes. I put on a happy face during the daytime, but I lay awake at night, trying to push the fears out of my head, confused about my new ambivalence towards him, hoping the visit would soon be over, and wondering how long it would take to walk to Seattle and the relative safety of my grandmother's house. It was the beginning of the end.